From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Growing up in East Baltimore, the son of Catholic immigrants, Jim Cabezas felt called to serve and protect. But as a rookie Baltimore City police officer in the 1970s, he witnessed rampant racism and abuse by fellow officers.
They had cuffed the man. His face was facing the cement, and they were kicking him. So in order to try to help the arrestee, I threw myself on top of the body. They picked me up and basically said, "You ever do that again, you will never get back up."
In his memoir, Eyes of Justice, Jim Cabezas details his lengthy career in law enforcement, including high-profile investigations of corrupt politicians, all while coping with the creeping loss of his sight. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Jim Cabezas joined the Baltimore Police Department at an uneasy time, a few years after the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the riots in Baltimore that followed, and the television coverage of police violence against Vietnam War protesters at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Cabezas' career would take him far from the Catholic schools he attended as a young man, all the way to The Block, a row of strip clubs on East Baltimore Street, nestled between the police department headquarters and the city courthouse. It would also take him deep into investigations of political corruption, grift, and bribery. In his new memoir, Eyes of Justice, Jim Cabezas details what led him to spend more than four decades in law enforcement, why he felt called to serve, and how, in the midst of this, he dealt with the gradual loss of his sight. Jim Cabezas, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much.
Why did you write this book?
I think I've led an interesting life, and I think for some, it could be an inspirational book that no matter what the challenge, you should never throw a towel in. That was part of it. And the other was that no one has ever written a comprehensive book about the rich history, unfortunately, that Maryland has with public corruption.
You were valedictorian of your 1971 class at the Police Academy.
Yes, ma'am.
A class of 50 men, 44 white, 5 African-American, and you,
yes,
the only Latino officer. 3 years after the 68 riots, was there any training about race or policing in Baltimore's African-American neighborhoods?
No. You know, they refer to something as public relations, but they never touched upon how to properly patrol in a minority community. And I think over the years, we've seen that that continues. And that's why my view is that the police department continues to operate in the 20th century.
20th century as when you joined it. Soon after you joined the force, you write, it was obvious that some of your fellow officers were racist.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the savage beatings of African Americans was absolutely horrible. In one situation, I responded to a call for a disorderly man, but two other officers got there before I did. They had cuffed the man. His face was facing the cement, and they were kicking him. So in order to try to help the arrestee, I threw myself on top of the body. They picked me up and basically said, or did say, "Hey, you ever do that again, you will never get back up."
You will never get back up means?
Meaning that if I get a call, you know, whether it's an armed robbery or whatever, no one's going to respond to help me.
So how did you react to all that?
I thought it was horrible. And as I was working in the Eastern District, which is a high crime area, I also learned about corruption that was going on in that district. And that was very unsettling to me because I joined the police department in part because my mother was from Chile. She came from a horrible dictator in that country. My father was from Nicaragua, same thing. And my father instilled in me how important the separation of powers are. And I joined the police department thinking that, boy, that's really good, you know, and perhaps I should do whatever I can to make sure that our country continues to have the separation of powers. I see law enforcement as the persons that are responsible to make sure that people are treated fairly, that they don't have their constitutional rights violated.
In other words, you really felt a sense that your job was to see justice
yes,
be done.
That's very well said.
And justice was not necessarily only in your hands.
That's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, there were some very good police officers also that worked there. I don't want to paint with a large brush, but I estimated that there were about 2 or 3% of police officers that just were brutal or they were on a take. And I think it continues today.
This is On the Record on WIP. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Jim Cabasis, author of the memoir Eyes of Justice, A Career Crime Fighter Battles Corruption and Blindness, written with Joan Jacobson. We're talking about his observations about racism and corruption in the Baltimore Police Department and his devotion to honest service. You witnessed other misconduct, officers sleeping and drinking while on duty, theft from the evidence room.
I mean, there were some police officers that, quite frankly, were just lazy. On my first day, I got a ride from what was known as Car 311, which had two officers assigned, and it was the shotgun car. There was so much crime there that they had a footman, which was me that day, that walked from the 1800 block of Greenman Avenue, which is at North, up to 24th Street. And on the way there, they didn't say a single word to me. They just said, get out. Okay. I didn't know why that was happening. But as I was going up and down the street to make sure that burglaries weren't taking place or anything else, I started thinking about the theory of omnipresence, which basically means the more visible the police officer, the less crime there's going to be. All right, so that, for me, described the point of how you're going to serve the public, protect the public. The other was, well, how are you going to serve the public? And I started thinking about it because it had never, ever been taught in the academy. And by the end of the shift, I thought the best thing I could do, to the extent possible, to become a member of that community, to improve the quality of life to the extent that I could. So, for instance, if I noticed that a telephone back then, public telephones, was out of order, I would contact the telephone company. If there was a sewer backed up, I would contact the Department of Public Works. And I made it a point to visit with every single owner. In that short stretch, there were 7 bars and a cut rate store. And as I met the public, I became friends with some, which provided me with communications. For instance, there was a large burglary ring going on, and a lady said to me as she was coming out of a grocery store at 24th and Brentwood Avenue, she said, follow me. And she said, look, there is a house, I'm going to give you the number, where the burglars, and she called them June bugs, they were juveniles, would stash the stolen goods in order for the fence to sell later on. And what she said is, you'll be able to hear them because they use an old shopping cart that has a broken wheel. And so, you know, went to the property division detectives. They set up the surveillance, and sure enough, you know, here came two broken shopping carts. And they were able to make very, very good arrests and stop the burglaries for a period of time in that area of the Eastern District.
Today, the Baltimore Police Department is under federal consent decree for unconstitutional and discriminatory police practices. What do you think it will take to reform the Baltimore Police Department?
Well, when Pomerleau was there...
This is Commissioner Donald Pomerleau.
Yes. He had a mantra that if you don't inspect, do not expect. And I don't think that's taking place right now in the city police department. And what that means is that the sergeants and lieutenants, shift lieutenants, cannot be house cats. They have to get out on the street and see what their officers are doing. That doesn't happen today. And I think that has to be reinstituted. Certainly the gun task force could not have taken place, what they did for so many months, if there had been someone inspecting. Quite frankly, I think there are four units that have to operate at their very best in any large police department. And the first is recruiting. Now, right now, the police department is way below its TO, table of organization. I would get together with the people from the armed forces and try, and I think I would be able to get it, names of people that are military police officers in all the different branches, and try to get those people to apply to the city police department. Secondly, the training academy has to have quality instructors that are current with the law and the promulgated policies of the police department. Thirdly, they need a very good intelligence unit to be able to provide information regarding large gangs. In the paper the other day, I read that the police commissioner designee, Michael Harrison, believes in not targeting areas, but individuals. And I think he's absolutely correct on that. And fourthly, they need a quality internal affairs division, which they do not have now. If they get those four units working well, I think we'll see an improvement in our police department.
But can you make those kinds of changes while there are officers who have had long careers on the force during the period that the abuses that you described were taking place?
Yeah, I think it's going to take a long time, at least 5 to 7 years, maybe more. There is a culture in that police department that I call a culture of isolation. So no sooner a rookie walks into a police district for his or her first work duty, someone will grab that person, a veteran police officer, and say, hey, look, you have to understand the rules here. No one out there is your friend. So your only friends are police officers. And the citizens are not. They'd rather have you die than be there. And that's what the rookies hear. That absolutely has to stop.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. My guest is Jim Cabasis, former Baltimore City police officer, former chief investigator with the Office of State Prosecutor. His memoir, written with Joan Jacobson, is Eyes of Justice, a career crime fighter battles corruption and blindness. Lots more to talk about when we're back. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. How do you stay an honest cop when surrounded by misconduct? How do you remain ethical while investigating government officials for fraud, bribery, and theft? Former Baltimore City Police Officer Jim Cabasis is my guest. His memoir, written with Joan Jacobson, is Eyes of Justice, a career crime fighter battles corruption and blindness. It details his experiences policing in the city during the 1970s and 80s, and later his work as chief investigator at the Office of State Prosecutor, which investigates abuses of power by elected officials. That office was set up in the 70s following some high-profile corruption cases, including the one of Vice President Spiro Agnew for kickbacks he took while Baltimore County executive. When you were assigned to the Office of State Prosecutor in 1978, what did you make of that opportunity?
I thought it was great because it was taking me into a professional office that had a large responsibility that ferrying out corruption. And it had to be done in a very, very quiet way so not to besmirch the reputation of a innocent person. And the mantra there basically was that we're going to proceed with a fundamentally fair investigation, abiding by both the state and United States Constitution, that we're going to put together investigative plans in order to determine what is the best way to get the best evidence to get to the truth, whether it serves to inculpate or exculpate. And as I said before, you really want to be careful that you don't damage the person's, any person's reputation that has not done anything wrong.
Many listeners will have heard of the cases you worked on, including that of former Baltimore County School Superintendent Dallas Dance's unreported consulting income, misleading election night robocalls arranged by a political consultant for former Governor Robert Ehrlich's campaign, and of course, former Baltimore Mayor Sheila Dixon's misappropriation of gift cards intended for needy families. When you look at the breadth of cases you worked on, what patterns do you see?
Well, let me say it this way. On average, the Office of the State Prosecutor has about 30 to 26 open cases at a time. 5 to 7 will have real impact if, in fact, the allegation is true and can be proven. I didn't particularly see a pattern. What I did see is that individuals lacked a moral compass.
That's Jim Cabasis, who spent more than 4 decades in law enforcement, working for the Baltimore Police Department and later leading investigations at the Office of the State Prosecutor. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his memoir, Eyes of Justice. Let's talk about you for a minute. What caused you to lose your eyesight?
When I was about 8 years old, I caught a flu. The doctor gave me a shot of penicillin, which I had had before, but I had an acute allergic reaction, which develops into something called Stevenson-Johnson syndrome. My skin exfoliated, my lips swelled so that the top of my lip was touching my nose, and when my parents, who did not drive, called an AMBO, they decided to take me to then City Hospital because I look like a burnt patient. And this is anecdotal, but when I left, there were 11 known cases in the Baltimore metropolitan area of people with Stevenson-Johnson syndrome. There were 9 who died. 1 lady walked out totally blind, and there was me. I still had eyesight.
And you had eyesight as a young person. Did you worry about the future as you were growing up?
You know, To some extent, but I have a very, very strong belief in religion. I'm a Catholic, and I sort of put it in God's hands. There was nothing I could do to stop. Obviously, I, you know, went to the very, very best ophthalmologist. I've had over 15 surgeries in an effort to try to maintain some sight. It's been difficult, but I've had wonderful friends, a wonderful life, that people who have supported me all the way. When I became blind, Steve Montanarelli, who was the state prosecutor at the time, said to our administrative assistant, Cindy Lewis, look, call the Department of Education and see if, in fact, there is something that can be done to aid him in his duties. And she found that there was an agency known as DOORS, which is an acronym for Department of Rehabilitation Services. It is that agency that has helped me through what are now just wonderful talking devices that you can continue to work. There's one program called JAWS, which I believe stands for Job Assisted Word Service, so that when I type on the computer, it reads the letter and then will read the word. And I can use keystrokes to go all over that document.
During the years that you were on the police force and early in your investigative career at the state prosecutor, your vision was deteriorating. How did you hide that from your colleagues?
That's a very good question. I constantly, because my eyes will become noticeably bloodshot. I was always wearing sunglasses. I may have four or five different pairs because the tint on the lenses were different. They actually aided me a great deal. Now, I very, very much did worry because sooner or later, somebody was going to have to notice, you know, hey, what about his vision? When I took the lieutenant's test, I memorized every line of the eye chart.
Who slipped you the eye chart in advance?
Well, it was in personnel files, my own file. I absolutely, every single letter, you know, it took me a while, but I was able to do it. I cheated on that eye exam. Now, I knew that as a supervisor, I would never have to drive. And I was still passing when we went to the range, the gun range.
That's amazing to me that you could still hit adequate targets with a gun. One of the most shocking moments you describe is your father's murder in 1972. How did you cope with that tragedy?
Back to religion. You know, he was my best friend, my best advisor. The day that it happened, which was December 28th of 72, my father, who was from Nicaragua, used to like to entertain, and he had many Hispanic friends. And so he would throw a party that would last 2 or 3 days. You know, the ladies would come and cook. The men would, you know, drink wine, smoke cigars. And so he was going to have a New Year's Eve party and wanted a new stereo system. So I said, Pop, you know, I'll take you. He said, oh, no, I'll be fine. And my father did not drive. He didn't like paying the insurance rates. But he had $800 in his pocket. That day, when he came home, he was in a cab. And it appears as if the cab driver went into his house and shot him 3 times. And that was a horrible, horrible, horrible day. For me, it was my religion that gets me by. But I was so angry at God that day. And I just had a shouting match with God. I accused him of not protecting my father and said such things. Well, God, were you out there collecting more money? For the church, where were you? And for the next 10 years, I lost my faith. But 10 years later, I went to a private confession, and I told him that I miss God and that I was confessing my sins. And so finally, I got back to the Lord. When I was walking out of there, I was singing a George Jones song which says, you know, don't shut the door on heaven because hell stays open all night long.
Well, congratulations on your career and congratulations on this book.
Thank you very much.
Jim Cabasis spent four decades in law enforcement as a Baltimore police officer and chief investigator for the Office of State Prosecutor. His new book, written with Joan Jacobson, is Eyes of Justice, A Career Crime Fighter Battles Corruption and Blindness, a memoir. They will speak a week from tomorrow, Thursday, March 7th, at the Ivy Bookshop, 6080 Falls Road, at 7 p.m. We've got a link to details at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us on The Record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.